Welcome to Watching Westworld, the officially unofficial podcast for Westworld on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 3, Episode 2, titled The Winter Line. Aaron, second viewing, what'd you think of it?
So, my first viewing, I remember thinking, this is a pretty straightforward plot. And then we got to the instant take, and people pointed out the aspect ratio changes, and I made a joke about, like, you know, oh, what if Maeve is actually, there's two different timelines here. And I started thinking about it that night, and the more I think about it, the more I'm convinced that, like every other season of Westworld before, they are trying to sell us on this twisted timeline approach. And I'm not sure exactly where it is, but I see signs of it. There's like some mysteries that would be neatly solved if we had multiple timelines. There's the kind of unexplainable decay and deterioration of Ford's shack. You know, it's been less than 100 days since it was a pristine laboratory, and now it looks like something Lara Croft or Indiana Jones would discover in some kind of fucking tomb with the dust and the cobwebs. To that extent, I still think it's incredible that in a single episode they move Maeve from, like, you know, the thing that we are afraid of. She'd be stuck in these worlds with no way out, and they got her into the real world, and in a single episode, and I think that is pretty cool. But I'm also hedging my bet because I think we've seen her in Samurai World at some point in the trailers, and it seems like that this maybe there's going to be simulations all the way down this season. But yeah, no,
doesn't excite me. No, that doesn't excite me. It's unfortunate.
And the big negative mark, other than the double D's showing up, was Stubbs's action scene. And I don't know if you saw this, but apparently the middle Hemsworth, as we're calling him now, the quite okay, perfectly fine Hemsworth, tore his bicep off his bone 2 days before that was filmed, making his left arm completely useless. So they improvised and had him get shot in that shoulder to explain why he couldn't use it. And then I still think they should pay a little bit more attention to how they frame and stage and block all their action. But, like, yeah, I'm going to cut him a little slack because a lot of the other action sequences have been choice in the first episode. I'm going to give him a pass on that. What did you think?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, with that information, it's a little more understandable. Although I will say Westworld's action scenes and choreography of those action scenes has never been its strong point.
Been a mixed bag for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know even if that scene would have been as good as we wanted it to be if all biceps were attached to all arms. But yeah, so you mentioned how straightforward this episode is, and it's interesting because you've got some theories on how things might be different with the timelines. And I think I almost hope for that at this point, which it's this double-edged sword where fuck these timey-wimey bullshit episodes. Like, you're trying to tell me a story about the evolution of a new species. That's difficult enough. Mm-hmm. And then when you introduce all of these strange timeline glitches and twists and turns, it just makes it doubly confusing. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of stuff on second watch in this episode that I found extraordinarily tedious. Hmm. And if it's meant to be read straightforward, as I think it is, or as I assumed it was, those things just really fall apart in second watch. Like, there's no reason to go back to this because everything they're doing, all the questions that they're encouraging me to ask, like, you know, what's happened to Hector? Has he been reset? Why aren't Maeve's powers working?
You're right. It's all a simulation.
How the hell did Lee survive? Like, none of that stuff matters at all on a second watch. And so it's very tedious watching the beginning of this episode twice.
You got the Groundhog Day effect of that. We see the intro happen like 3 or 4 times in a row.
Right, right.
So you've really watched it 16 times if you've seen it twice. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm almost hoping that there's something to go back and enjoy in subsequent watches based on like a timeline trick or something.
Yeah, I do think that
which is weird. I don't like, you know, saying that because season 2 did a lot of that and it really annoyed me.
But you found it rewarding on a rewatch too, correct? Uh-huh. I think that so, like, I want to push back a little bit on the whole timey-wimey stuff because I find that the relationship of that being tedious is in a direct proportion to how well it's done. Mm-hmm. Like, if it's really adds to the intrigue and the sense, like a sense of unsettled, being kind of unstuck in time, it tries to sell a particular scattered way of thinking or a mental illness, like those things can be done to great effect. And it's, you know, but it's so it remains to be seen whether this season they do a balance between. But that's, and the other thing that always kind of handicaps these shows is if we have kind of cottoned on to the fact that there's already multiple timelines in episode two, that means that some of the stuff that they're going to think is are clever reveals for people that are closely watching the show, people that are mega fans, people like us, people like you listening. That's where you tend to run the risk of, like, you know, having your core fan base say, oh, this is tedious. But we'll see.
And I think you're right about that. But I also don't think that this episode offered anything, unless there is some big trick, which is why I'm saying I'm kind of hoping for it. It didn't offer any of those things that you would kind of be rewarded by watching a second time.
Yeah. I just have a feeling we haven't even scratched the surface with the simulation shit.
Yeah. You're probably right.
And that can be both good and bad.
Do you know what the winter line is?
I do. The winter line, as Wikipedia informed me, is a series of defensive fortifications set up just above the ankle and just below Rome on the peninsula, the Italian peninsula.
Yeah, just between Rome and Naples.
Yeah, and these were the kind of the last defense against the Allies late in the war. And while eventually broken, they managed to hold off the Allied advance through the winter of 43 from December to June of 1944. Thus, it's called the Winter Line. And this is apparently the setting in Westworld, just from all the things we know, the map, the language we're speaking, the partisans, you know, like all the different factions. This is a late Italian front of the World War II.
Yeah, and I like it on the sort of thematic front too, because this episode is very much a mounting of the defense of humanity, right? Like taking Maeve, getting her on the side of humans, whereas the first episode was all mounting of the offense. Like, where are the humans and the hosts going to come together to fight against the humans?
Yeah.
This episode is the reverse of that. And so the Winter Line kind of makes a lot of sense.
Ooh, and also it's kind of grim, because if we're on the wrong side of that Winter Line, we're fighting, and that's kind of what Serac says at the end, we're fighting a war that's already been lost unless something changes.
And ultimately, I guess the Winter Line was broken.
Yeah. No, Mussolini is is still not in power. I don't know if you kept up with the news, but yeah. Something about him being...
I've been all about the coronavirus lately. When did that happen?
3 weeks ago.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the episode description on HBO.
Uh-huh.
Because they're doing these pretty simplistic ones, and it just says, people put up a lot of walls, bring a sledgehammer to your life. And I was trying to see how that applied to this episode.
They're going Matthew Weiner Mad Men on this stuff.
I guess so. So the things I came up with that sort of match that description are Maeve being put into this prison that doesn't exist, these walls being put up around her, and she eventually sledgehammers her way out of that. And also Dolores putting up this block, this corruption in Bernard's mind, which he's trying currently to get around. You know, like keeping him from accessing his memories again. We'll see what he does with that.
There's even some super sneaky stuff. There's some super sneaky Stubbs theories that I want to get into when we get to Bernard scanning himself and et cetera.
Okay. Super excited to hear those.
Before we get the episode, I wanted to say something. This is kind of a momentous occasion in our life. Happy anniversary, partner. We've been doing this to the day for 10 years.
To the day? Wow.
Well, and here's the thing is, like, I remember 5 years ago or 6 years ago when I was writing the about section of our website, I actually did some sleuthing, because there's a couple ways you could point to when did Bald Move start? Because our first episode published was published March 19th, 2010. But it turns out we backdated that, because we actually went live with our PAX coverage. And we wanted to have the introduction episode as if it had been out there a week before, but we didn't have the website ready to go until like 3 days after that. So we did some backdating to lend our PAX coverage a certain legitimacy. But you could say, like, you know, the day we drunkenly came up with the idea for Bald Move, the first time we record an episode. But the date we're going with is March 24th, 2010. And it's the 10th anniversary.
All right.
I wish this were more joyous circumstances, because it feels, you know, like it, like anyone with a wedding or a graduation coming up probably feels the same way. It's somewhat muted. But I just want to tell everybody on this, which is now that Game of Thrones is off the air, our flagship show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for all the listens, all the subscriptions, all the likes, all the love and support you guys have given us through the years, because that's why we made it to 10.
Yeah, it's amazing. So, I didn't think we'd ever get this far.
No. This is Rehoboam himself couldn't have predicted this,
especially after that year two where we sort of almost gave up podcasting.
Yeah, yeah, we're a giant divergence in the podcasting simulation. So again, thanks to everybody, and congratulations to us. All right, now let's talk about Westworld.
Yeah, let's do it. We start off with Maeve finding herself in Warworld, which is she's very quickly reunited with Hector, who's part of that world's resistance movement. They sneak past a group of Germans interrogating some citizens to find out who stole their battle plans. These Germans are speaking Italian. Is that accurate to the period?
I think some of them are, some of them aren't, right? Like, it seemed like I thought the commander was
definitely
shouting in German.
Yeah.
I don't know. It makes sense that you'd have, like, I know many, many, many American servicemen learned like Farsi and other Arabic dialects, because it's just much easier to interface with the locals when you're occupying them.
Yeah.
So I don't know how historical it is, but I imagine it's fairly historical.
Probably.
Plus, in Westworld, they've got like they got this like everyone can understand every language, and it's all ultimately how it looks and feels to the guests. So,
So then they manage to sneak past those Germans who are interrogating some citizens to find out who stole their battle plans. And they manage to escape and make it to a plane, which is unfortunately a trap. So Maeve kills herself to try and get another shot at escape. Speaking of Italian, I really love that moment where she's like just totally dismayed and confused, surprised at herself that she speaks Italian.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but it's just a small moment, a look on her face that just says so much.
See, and I think that's what makes the justification of rewatches is like, you know, you just take in the art and artifice of it. There's a couple of fun little Easter eggs here, like the fact that Ettore is, I guess, the Italian version of Hector. And the way that like Ivan is a Russian way of saying John.
Yeah.
And Isabella was the name of the woman who was Hector's cornerstone back in Westworld when he was an outlaw.
Right.
So that was kind of neat. I also thought that they did a pretty good job of like, at first you were trying to wrestle with yourself of whether Maeve herself was deluded. And you're like, maybe not. And then once you kind of got that sorted, then it was like whether Hector himself is deluded. Mm-hmm. And I thought like on a first watch, it was pretty nice, you know, pretty good keeping us on our toes and keeping us off balance.
Oh, yeah. The actors do a great job here of sort of bringing a slight bit of confusion to it, because you think you know what's up based on last season.
Yeah.
But then you slowly understand, oh, actually, I don't know what's up here. Hector's been reset or something. And I really got that in the first watch.
Yeah, I hope we get to see Hector again, because he's a cool character, and he looked like he was very sexy and menacing last year and the years before in his all black leather desperado getup, but he's equally sexy as like an Italian James Bond fighting against the Nazis. I would like, and also it seems like Maeve has genuine feelings for him.
Yeah.
In the same way she does for her daughter. So I hope we get to see him back.
There's this line in there that Maeve says about, if I'd known your plan was to run the whole way out of worn sensible shoes, which I didn't catch that line until my second watch. But the first time around, I caught when later in this very same episode, she tromps off into the woods in 6-inch heels to meet Lee to go on a journey across the desert. And I'm like, really? The disconnect there between
what she actually does
and what she says.
Yeah, like what if it would have been kind of cool and badass if she'd have blown out Hector's bits and just taken his shoes. They're a little bit big, and she stuffs the toes with fake orders and fake secrets, so she, you know, she can tromp around.
She can just turn off her pain sensors in the bottom of her feet and just take her
shoes
off.
That's true, but that probably works the same way with the stilettos, right? You know.
Yeah, I would want a more stable base, but
yeah. Oh, I guess that's true.
Anyway, so there's a divergence in South China Sea, which is where Bernard is, and he's dropped off at Westworld. We get to see the town with the white churches all burnt out.
Did you know that that was actually, that set burnt down in real life because of the California wildfires, and they just used it as is?
So I heard. I wasn't sure if that was apocryphal or not, but
pretty cool detail. It was still smoldering, which surely they had to add that, like some dry ice or something.
I don't think the thing had been on fire the day before.
Yeah, they're not shooting on a set that's actually combusting, I don't think.
No.
But it was a nice effect, because it really did feel like this fucking place got gutted, wasted.
Then we move on to Felix and another tech repairing Maeve, and he's acting pretty strange around her.
Yep.
She wanders out into the facility where she encounters Sylvester, and he calls security on her. So she goes to the lab and tries to lobotomize herself. Lee shows up to stop her, claiming she's on a new narrative, and she's confused because she saw him die. And Lee says, actually, you know, she didn't see him die, and he wants to help her get to the Valley Beyond.
So is that screw? I have questions about the screw thing and why Maeve would do it. Like, that screw up the nose is how they, I understand, is how they retire a host.
Yeah.
But it can be undone because they did it to Abernathy and he recovered. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of things wrong with him, but most of that was because his brain was bulging with guest data.
Yeah.
So, like, what was she actually trying to do here?
I think she's trying to put herself out of commission. I don't know how much she knows about the process, but definitely.
Yeah. Oh, maybe. So I guess you're right. She doesn't maybe understand exactly everything about her own nature, although I don't know. I guess, again, I still think it's a problem that I don't really know what kills a host. Mm. And specifically, I don't know what kills a woke host, because the gunshot through the head doesn't hurt their marble. So, you know, what the hell's going on here? But anyway, I just wanted to talk about that, the screw suicide. And also,
she sees how desperate her situation is, how much of a loop she's stuck in, and how there's no way out, and she's just done with it.
Yeah. And the first time I watched this, I had some problems with, like, you know, God, they're doing this, like, you know, this naked host sneaking around in this glass prison. But it's all a sim. And then, so then when I realized it's all simulation, my thing is, like, why is anybody watching what this host that's a target of simulation is doing? But then like I said, I'm very convinced that this was just an elaborate way to test Maeve and what she was capable of. I mean, it's essentially what Serac all but says. So this wasn't a trap or a way to get information out of her, although
I think it started as that, right? It started as a way to figure out what she knew about where the forge data went, and then it morphed when they saw that, okay, A, she doesn't have that information, and B, she's kicking our asses when it comes to the simulation. It switched to the mode where, okay, now I see what she can do, let's co-opt her.
Okay, that's probably accurate.
Yeah.
And also you wonder, or at least I do, I wonder how many iterations of this simulation she's been through, because she doesn't know. Mm-hmm. You know, the show wants you to believe it's the first one, but, like, why would we believe that? Maybe some of these lazy things, maybe having these breadcrumbs so she can escape it was part of the test after they abandoned the fact that, because they would find out pretty quickly that, oh, she doesn't know where the Li-Fi cannons were pointed.
Yeah.
You know, fuck, what's plan B?
And like we see later, you know, the simulation is running a lot faster than the humans outside of the simulation. So,
right.
Yeah, they could have iterated through that many times.
Especially since the other way, like, maybe they're testing for fidelity, and they are, if maybe these woke hosts aren't able to be simulated by Rehoboam, but they were using that simulated data to build a profile for them. Hmm. Like, what if she's no longer a divergence because Rehoboam has seen her live 1,000 different war world lifetimes?
That could be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like,
could get a copy of Dolores, maybe they could predict her too.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And I'm thinking, anytime you see a straightforward Westworld episode, that's when you want to put your hand on your gun, because they're about to hijack your caboose or whatever the Westworld saying would be.
There's some pretty delicious meta stuff in here too. When Lee shows up and she's like, I saw you die what's going on here? Because, and then he said, are you sure you saw me die? You were busy riding off into the sunset. And I feel like we as an audience are in the same position where in this moment you're thinking, oh shit, Lee's back, which A is fantastic because Lee's one of my favorite characters. But B, I thought I saw him die. When I went back and I watched this episode, you see him take a shot or two.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Then they cut away and there's a lot more gunfire, but you don't see him die.
Right.
But like, and so there's this like very meta moment where they're sort of talking to the audience too.
No, with gunshots, like, I know it's not nothing, but you can get, as long as you don't get shot in like an aorta or your heart or your lungs, most gunshots are very, very survivable. And
especially in the future, right?
Especially in the future.
When they've all but conquered death, yeah.
Yeah, they can just weld flesh back together with a little fucking magic light pin. Like, I had no problem thinking that he would survive with a bit of a limp, and he was still tender, and like, that all made sense to me.
Yeah.
So it sold the illusion.
Okay, let's move on to Bernard making it to the facility where he killed Teresa, and he finds his personal tablet and Stubbs, both of which are very much pieces of technology and both of which are very much damaged. Bernard patches up Stubbs and tells him he's looking for Maeve so they can stop Dolores, and Stubbs agrees to help him.
Okay, I'm trying to think if now is the time to deploy my Stubbs theory. And I kind of want to get it out there. But first, I want to, we talked about Lee, whether he's dead or alive. Do we know that he's dead or alive? Because that's still an open question for me.
Probably
dead. Probably dead. But like everything that we saw in this simulation is convincing because it could be true. So we could, and also how, although I guess if they had a living Lee, they would do a better job of coming up with simulation.
Yeah, they didn't have very good fidelity on him.
Unless Lee deliberately lied on about his cornerstone so that Maeve would be able to see through it. But then he would have to know that they're... I don't know. This fucking show. Okay. So, Stubbs is going to be put in here to help protect Bernard. And Bernard is going to immediately trust all this. Is to be true that he was programmed by Ford to do this thing, to get the hosts off the island and then cover up the tracks and then retire themselves. Mm-hmm. But this robot who's got, otherwise we've seen how perfect their gunshot accuracy is, can't hit his explosive vertebra from literal point blank range. Mm-hmm. That's weird and not consistent with the story they're trying to say. We also, one of the new scenes that we see in Bernard's visions that he goes through when he's cycling through himself and analyzing himself is Holoris, which is Dolores's robot brain in a Charlotte Hale body, is constructing another body inside the Mesa complex. Hmm. And that's a new thing that was shot. Mm-hmm. So there's a theory that the Stubbs bot is like a backup control system to the corruption she enforced on Bernard, to where if he goes back to Westworld to try to, you know, meet up with Maeve or, you know, investigate his own history, that this is like a stopgap, a version of Stubbs she created that will subtly try to thwart his success.
It is a little strange that he's prepared to leave this island. Having not accomplished his mission.
Yeah.
He goes there and he experiences some failure, right? They can't actually find Maeve. They're not sure if she's even in the park, but he immediately gets onto this other clue, which is given to him by the search of his memory, which we already know has some kind of, according to him, corruption, which Dolores put there. So he's following essentially a clue that Dolores left for him.
Yeah.
Or at the very least didn't feel fit to remove from him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a little disconcerting, I guess, if Bernard is the hope for humanity.
And if it's not Stubbs, who did Holoris create inside Westworld? And they're probably still there because they were scanning everybody for their humanity, etc. Like it seems likely that they're still there. So who else who could it possibly be? Anyway, I just want to throw that out there so we can maybe keep that in our mind as we go through these Stubbs scenes.
Speaking of Stubbs, that performance by Hemsworth, the lesser Hemsworth, is fucking amazing. It is so creepy. And I watched the after stuff on this, And they said, this is all him. Like, they did a little bit of voice effect, but they didn't do any CG on this dude. He just gave that performance. It's so creepy. It's like, there are creepy moments in Blade Runner with androids.
Yeah.
But this, in my opinion, surpassed any of those in creepiness. Yeah.
It's very, like, zombie or, you know, old mummy coming to life kind of horror.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because, like, every time we've seen someone portray a fucked up host, we're like, oh, man, what the acting here. It's like, oh, look at you know, what Jeffrey Wright's doing. Look at, maybe we're just overestimating how hard it is to play a fucked up robot.
I guess, yeah.
You just kind of jerk your head, and then it's like, oh, my God, he looks just like a robot losing his shit because we don't know what a robot losing its shit would look like. So it probably looks like that.
Yeah. That's fair. We don't have any real world comparison.
But I'm high on Hemsworth's stock right now, so I'm not going to say that it's not an amazing acting job because I quite enjoyed it.
When does he surpass Liam as the second best Hemsworth?
I think I already made an argument in Instatake that he did. Like, I mean, what's okay. Liam got? Like fucking Hunger Games? Yeah. He played a cuck in Hunger Games, and on the strength of that, we're gonna put the previously known as lesser and now the middling Hemsworth above Liam. He's already above Liam. Liam's in his dust.
Fair. Promotion. Official.
Liam's not worth a half-torn bicep of this guy.
All right. Maeve wakes up again. This time, her and Hector make their escape immediately. And Maeve stops short of the plane trap, says goodbye to Hector, and meets Lee in the woods, and they mount horses and ride off into the desert. This is the scene I was talking about where she tromps off into the woods in 6-inch heels, mounts a horse in 6-inch heels, rides into a desert in 6-inch heels. This is not going well for her.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much there is to talk about in this scene because it's kind of a retread of a previous scene, just faster.
Mm-hmm.
So then we move back to Bernard and Stubbs finding Maeve's body in cold storage, but her marble's missing. They apparently didn't, I don't know. There are a few scenes here which are like intercut that might be a little hard to suss out.
Yeah, and so someone had a theory that the body that's in the Hale, or the marble that's in the Hale body, is Maeve, and that Dolores went to cold storage before she left the island and pulled it out of Maeve's head. But we saw her see Maeve dead as she was like on the ground as she was leaving Westworld, implying that unless Maeve already has a giant hole in her head with a missing marble, which means they probably wouldn't put her in storage, someone else had to have done it. Probably not Dolores.
I mean, is the theory that Charlotte or Dolores took Maeve's marble and gave it to Serac? Because Serac clearly has it.
Yes. I mean, I guess the theory doesn't say that, but that's like a logical inference you could make. Okay. I mean, honestly, that's one of the huge mysteries. How did Serac get the marble? Is just plain old industrial espionage, paid someone to go in there and cut it out of her head? How did he know that Maeve was special?
And yeah, I guess the super interesting question, which we're going to get to here in a second, is why would somebody want this data from the Forge? Mm-hmm. The host data is interesting. I think it's a little more easy to explain like why they would want the guest data. But that host data, I'm not sure why that would be so valuable to them.
I don't know, unless you've got these... because wait, didn't the Forge also host the guest data? I guess I thought it was both. So like I could see...
It might be both,
yeah. Because obviously the host data or the guest data is massively valuable. And we talked about Rehoboam being like two sides of the other side of the Forge coin, that the Forge is got all this information and simulation that's accurate inside, and that Rehoboam's got the simulation that's accurate on the outside. If you merge those together, that might be like the grand unification theory that he needs to just completely subjugate all of humanity.
Yeah.
So I can see why, or I guess control, lead us into a promised land, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I don't know about his motives, but we'll talk about that near the end.
Yeah.
So then we move on to Maeve and Lee making it to the Forge, and Lee incorrectly assumes that Maeve beamed the hosts out and would know where they went. When Lee declares his intentions of saving her life, Maeve realizes he's a host, because those weren't his intentions. And that revelation breaks down the very fabric of her world, revealing its artificial nature.
Mm-hmm. And they do a nifty camera move where they change the aspect ratio of the shot by simultaneously pulling in and zooming out on both Lee and Maeve's faces, which previously these changes to the cinematic aspect ratio, revealing the black bars, was our clue of when we were in a simulation, when we are not. And they rewrote that rule to show when a host realizes they're in a simulation. And I'm not sure how I feel about that. I'm not super bothered, but there's, like, as we previously discussed, there's so many tools that they have to completely change a narrative on a dime that, you know, it's just like it's like what kills a host in a microcosm. If anything can happen and anything be rewritten and nothing is real, then there's very little reason to care.
Yeah.
And they have to be very, very, very careful using these tools so that they're always in ways they're interesting or ways that, you know, there are in retrospect ways we can kind of detect when we're being fooled, but we don't know it yet. And I don't know that they've always been totally careful in how they use those tools in the past. So,
yeah,
but sick, sick shot.
Yeah, I love the effects of this sort of, it's better than the holodeck. I'll give them that.
Maybe I can put some more Hemsworth commentary here, because I like this incarnation of Stubbs where he's like a less stiff, nerdy Teddy. Like, he's just a panache driven quip machine. Like, Bernard's talking about, or Stubbs like, yeah, you can't make these humans go away like you can since. And he's like, that's why I have you. And he's like, yeah, that's why I'm looking forward to retirement. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Good stuff. Then Maeve ponders why whoever's running the simulation would want the location of the Forge data and how she can break the rules of this world to get out. She performs an experiment which involves calling in a couple technicians to blow their minds by asking what the square root of -1 is, thereby overtaxing the system. It works, and she decides she's going to scale that experiment up.
I think this is fun, and it does work, but I'm not sure exactly how. Like, how does this question end?
I don't know. I'm not a mathematician. I'm sure mathematicians across the globe were just laughing their ass off about, of course, -1 square root. Yeah.
Well, I'm not even getting to that far. I'm talking about in the simulation, like, if you just came up when I was busy with a weird, like, you know, if I came in and there's someone I'd never seen in our studio before, and you came up to me and said, hey, don't worry about this. In fact, what do you think about the square root of -1? I'd be like, I don't give a fuck about the square root of -1. What does this dude do in the studio or lady? These guys are simulated to be Delos techs. Why would they be distracted into an obscure, you know, it's like it's not even the math problems. Not what I'm having problems with. It's just like the nature of the simulated reality. But
What the reality chooses to ignore and engage with, yeah.
And I think that Nolan and Joy are just going for, like, don't worry about it. We're going for maximum cool or funny, and don't think too hard about it. It's literally a Rick and Morty plot, you know?
It is literally, yeah. Like a season 1 Rick and Morty plot.
Yep.
The scene is very cool, and it's very funny. I love the moments with Lee and Maeve here where he grabs her shoulder. He's like, you feel real. She slaps him across, and he's like,
"Cause he's just
that felt real."
And his office has got tons of busts of her and, like, schematic drawings. Like, he's just obsessed. And that part of the simulation is accurate. And his also shocked face of, like, I've been plagiarized. It's really. And then his, like, you know, like when she says, what's the square root of -1? And the techs are like, what the hell is this? He's like, FEMA code breakers won World War II. Study your history. Uh-huh. All that stuff is just really, I thought, really funny and worked well.
Oh, yeah. Some great writing in that scene.
Although, this is why another reason I think that there might be some multiple loops here is because it seems that the computing power it takes to blow the simulation's mind keeps getting more and more. Like, at first, you can make it fuck up by just Lee realizing he's not a robot or he's not a real person. Mm-hmm. It breaks the simulation. Then it's two field techs arguing about the nature of square root of -1. Then the final scene, it's every field tech that you can get your hands on in a simulation arguing simultaneously and at length, as every German and Italian and villager has a copy of their plans, and they're all revealed to be traitors. Like, holy, so is Serac increasing the complexity of the simulation as she gets closer and closer? Or is this a sign that she's doing this in an iteration? And like the first few attempts, they didn't bother to simulate it with that much fidelity, and they accorded her more and more respect in each attempt. I don't know, because it does seem like if it's once,
I think it's that last thing you said, the respect angle. Like they kind of like had maybe some, you know, just enough to keep the facade up. You know, they're spinning up EC2 servers, right? It's like,
yeah, right. They're
they've just got this automatic process, just throwing more computing power at it. And as she cracks each system, they sort of spin up more in response to her. I think that's probably accurate. Yeah.
Okay.
Given what he talks about at the end with, you know, testing her abilities and seeing how well she did.
Also, some people were skeptical about whether you can do shit like this. And there is escaping, because we have virtual computing right now. Like I've on my computer, I have a virtual computer that I can spin up, and it's in a sandbox, which means it's completely separated and firewalled from the outside system. But it's a fully functional computer within a computer. And it's useful for, like, if you wanted to experiment with malware or like open up a risky link, you can fire up your virtual machine, see what it does. And then if it infects the virtual machine, you can just, you know, roll it back to a previous version, delete it, recreate it, whatever. And it doesn't hurt your existing system, your physical real system. But there are also things called sandbox attacks, where from within the virtual machine, you are able to penetrate to the physical machine and then fuck with it. And that's essentially what Maeve is doing. And
yeah,
it's also
very cool. She says that, right? She says they use the same bits of code in their simulation that they did in the real system. And so she figures out the simulation. She understands the real system.
Yeah, and it's probably sloppy and poor security, but that's, you know, that's part of the plot. She's talking about the humans being sloppy, lazy, or maybe leaving breadcrumbs for her to follow. But this is entirely possible in the real world. It also reminded me of like a year or two after Minecraft was created, someone created a 16-bit computer within the world of Minecraft.
Yeah,
and like, if you had a sufficient computing power, you could probably use that to create an instance of Minecraft running within Minecraft. And, you know, I just think these things, like, I think people underestimate, like, what is actually possible when you're talking information theory and programming and AI and robotics.
Yeah, just a bunch of ones and zeros.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
All the way down. So we're all simulation. What are these? Are these fingers? You believe these are fingers, Jim?
I just see ones and zeros. I see green lines streaming down my monitor. Okay, let's move on to Bernard and Stubbs going into the Park 4 facilities, where they see that Maeve is gone. Bernard thinks it's a corruption of his code, so he jacks himself into the computer and does a self-diagnosis as Stubbs violently, but not too violently, buys him time.
You're just going to skip past the double D's appearance?
No, we'll talk about it.
Okay.
Let's bring it up. Boo, yeah, double D's.
Read the room, guys. Read the fucking room.
Yeah.
It's also a stealth Jurassic Park reference, which I think I would have gotten organically had I not just almost blacked out from the audacity of what I was seeing.
Yeah.
And this prestige HBO show.
I didn't even hear Costa Rica the first time. Second time I did.
Yeah, which that was the setting, you know, is of Isla Nebula, or I forget.
Nublar, I think.
Nublar.
How you say it?
Yeah, that's the island in Costa Rica that Jurassic Park takes place
in. Yeah, and I think that startup probably would have been InGen, right?
Yeah. So you've got a nice little, you've got a very nice, subtle Jurassic Park reference, which is another great Michael Crichton work. Inside a lousy, terrible, eye-gouging out cameo by the Double D's.
I do like to think that InGen started their experiments with dragon parts, artificially created dragon parts within this park, and tried to merge that DNA with the dino DNA. Mm-hmm.
The female frog was just the DNA. That was just a cover story.
Oh, you think it worked, the dragon DNA?
Yeah. It was too unbelievable. So they went with frog, female frogs. White Rose helped them cover it all up.
Perfect.
There's got to be a grand Jurassic Park, Westworld, Mr. Robot unification theory. Speaking of grand unification theories.
Absolutely.
All right.
So, Park 4, if it needs to be mentioned, is medieval world of some type. We don't know the actual name, but
fantasy world is the other one.
Fantasy
Westeros world is some are calling it.
Yeah.
Which means we're down to, we've got five out of the six Delos destinations identified. Westworld, Shogun World, Fantasy World, Raj World, and War World.
There's still one less. The last one.
What is it?
Water World.
Water.
Yeah. I mean, Nolan said it was going to be different. How much different could you get than Water World?
How about this crazy theory?
Let's bring Kevin Costner back. Let's de-age him digitally. Let's get him a coffee filter to piss in, and let's go. Let's do this. I'm ready.
I would be down for Waterworld. How about this theory?
Yeah.
What if it's Future World, and that's where Dolores actually is with Caleb?
See, yes. I mean, that's clearly a much better version of this than Waterworld. But
I don't know. I don't know that that's true. But like, that is definitely something that could be happening.
Man, which... at some point, it just feels like it's a way to prolong this series. Instead of getting to the fucking point that they want to make, they stick all the characters in cages and let them run around testing the walls forever.
I don't know, because I do think that, well, it just depends whether this is tighter than season two. But like, it could be possible that each chapter of the Westworld saga is telling us something a little bit different, that or something that needs to be like foundationally understood before we proceed to the next level. Because the end game is humans get to go extinct, or AI go extinct, or we do like a end of the Matrix kind of uneasy alliance. Like, there's not very many ways where this show can go like that, right?
Yeah, there are so essentially like, three.
The destination is very much, or the journey is very much a destination. So, like, I'm fine with them, like, revealing that, oh, actually, there's one last barrier, as long as we understand something. Because, like, in the first season, the hosts were unambiguously the hero. We were all rooting for them. Mm-hmm. Second season, we see that the hosts can be just as corruptible and just as evil and just as reactionary as humans can be. If the third season teaches us that we humans are also on our own loop, like, I could see them all fitting together for something really cool and mind-blowing in season four, or whenever they're going to finish the season series. Do we know? Have they said, like, how many?
I don't think so.
Shit, we could be watching a final season. Is that possible?
I bet they would tell us if that were the case.
But why? It's so much, you have people guessing right up to the last final reveal.
That's fair. It's just that that stuff typically leaks.
Yeah, well, that's very much true. If everybody was like moving on to other projects, you would start seeing that in their IMDb pages and their LinkedIn profiles.
Yeah.
Jawadi's like, I'm looking to score a major series, out of work.
So there's another little bit here that I appreciated, which is this minstrel playing the Westworld theme on the lute. That was nice. And then there's this question that Bernard's got with this corruption. You know, he suspects that Dolores put some kind of corruption in his code, and that would keep him from building a tablet that would enable him to see the corruption and diagnose it. But isn't Bernard essentially just a walking tablet? And when you combine that with the idea that this code looks like nothing to me,
it's kind of
like
he
would never be able to self-diagnose.
Yes, but I guess it's like if you had a laptop that you knew was built by, like, a hostile government down to its network layer. Like, you could put whatever software on there, but you could never really trust it. Mm-hmm. And he goes in and thinks, like, well, here's a potentially clean, Dolores wouldn't know to fuck with this potential thing. Like, I mean, the logic's sound, but you're right. Like, the idea that he could be in a simulation, or Dolores could have put or even Ford, who developed all this shit, could have put some things in place to kind of, like, keep Bernard in a little mental pin. Those are all open questions and good ones.
Yeah.
One last thing. If Park 5 is Future World, or maybe it's Space World, I would love, if we're just doing pointless cameos, I would love to see the entire crew of the Rocinante just like piled up in like a QA room, all bullet holes through them. Just pan over it. Just pan over Amos and Naomi and Alex and everybody.
They'd all have to be naked. Bobby. I don't know if they're signing on for that. Although Cass Anbar has been working overtime.
Yeah, I'm
on
pretty
his body.
Sure. I'm pretty sure a couple of them, but I think you could just have them in their uniforms, like they haven't been hosed off yet, or they could be all haphazardly piled to where no one's privates are shown. I mean, we've seen Stephen Strait's ass.
It's true.
How many times in the show already? So just have him on the top of the pile with his ass up, and we're good to go. this is a giant Expanse joke. If you don't know.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to Maeve's grand plan to overtax the simulation. It pays off when every single German officer ends up with a copy of the stolen battle plans in their pocket. This confusion combined with the calculations of the square root of -1 result in the entire world freezing up. And with that accomplished, Maeve accesses the systems of the simulation and uses a robot in the facility to pull her core and try and escape. It doesn't quite work, and the robot is eventually brought down by a lot of gunfire.
Yeah.
This is a really cool scene. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It was really cool. I thought it, like, the slapstick way of her dealing with these Nazis was intrinsically funny. And a pretty elegant way to, like, overwhelm a simulation. The traitor gamut was really funny.
And just the effect. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me. I'm always, like, blown away when they do the stop motion with the camera moving. And, like, yes, it's been done since The Matrix. It's been 20 years since we've sort of been, have our minds blown by this effect, but...
But this was different. Did you see they actually staged this and did a Steadicam shot through, like they had all these rods holding up the German soldiers, like being falling in the air and on all these contorted positions. And they were actually real people just doing the freeze robot stuff. And then they digitally painted out the rods and they added blood and like some smoke effects. But like it was a real shot, unlike The Matrix where they, you know, green screened everything, composited everything. And I thought that was... I mean, it's weird. It's just like doing it the hard way, it feels like. But I like it. I like when people use traditional, like, practical effects over just doing fuck it everything in the computer.
Yeah, and then they had to digitally go in, I guess, and stop people's hair from moving and stuff like that because, you know, this is a full simulation freeze, which would affect
except
everything.
Except for Lee, that's the thing, is like she made some kind of thing about spinning him off into some kind of other process, but... Mm-hmm. I'm not sure everything tracks as far as the freezing and Lee still being mobile and all that kind of stuff, but I don't know. Maybe he's a real marble because there's a whole aquarium tank of them. Maybe there's select people that are they're individuals inside the simulation.
I'm trying to think, is there a reason why she had to stop this simulation in order to take control of that robot?
I think it's just the most expeditious way to get out of the to freeze everything so she can go to the controller room without and get her hands on a pad maybe. I don't know. You're right. Like it's maybe just the fastest way to get out of the situation.
Maybe a distraction too.
Yeah.
For the human monitors.
Yeah, although it didn't seem like that's the other thing is like no one on the outside ever felt like they knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And also Serac is comfortable with sacrificing several of his people's lives just to throw Maeve through his gauntlet, which, you know, I guess that tracks. He's a big, rich asshole that's fair. Trying to control us all. What's the death of a few hourly stiffs, right?
Absolutely.
What's the death of a few million people for some GDP? Am I right?
Oh,
am
yeah.
I right?
I'll take GDP over lives any day. Why not?
Yeah.
Before Lee potentially exits stage left for the final time, I have to give him one more prop. That line about not being frozen, just scared shitless, is so good. The way he plays that, I love this actor. He's so good. I hope we see him in a lot more stuff. Because man,
I'm not ruling him being in Westworld.
Yeah, that's fair. So then we go to Bernard, who knows now that Dolores was looking for Liam. So they set off to find him, and Bernard gives Stubbs a new cornerstone, which is protect Bernard Lowe at all costs.
Still feels like a little bit of a dick. Oh, and actually, can we go back to the Maeve scene?
Okay.
What was Maeve's plan? Because the big criticism I had after I saw this thing, I watched this episode 3 times. The last one was I was kind of background and why I was taking my notes and stuff. But like, it seems like if I was in this situation, it's like breaking out of prison. You know, do you go the Andy Dufresne where you carefully build something over years and years till you know it's going to work and then you spring it all in one point so that no one can suspect it and no one can stop you? Or you just like are cool with the guards coming around the corner and you're just hacksawing the bars and you get known as like a escape attempt? Like, what was her plan once she gets this marble out with the robot and runs outside? What the hell was she going to do with it? Is this just like her trying to... You know, she's on like a slave ship crossing the Atlantic and she just jumps overboard because that's better than being in the system? Or was this an actual escape attempt? She was just wanting to die, correct?
I think so. I mean,
because that's the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah, I think like she was either going to get out or die trying. And I think she has a pretty limited knowledge of the outside world at the moment. Like, I think she's been explained what the outside world is, and she's seen some of the tech when she got as far as, you know, the labs and got as far as the train. Mm-hmm. But, like, she doesn't realize that you get outside of this facility that they've got you in, running the simulation, and there's a whole world to contend with. And you look like a robot. So, like, yeah, where are you going to go? There's nowhere for you to go. But I don't think she quite realizes that.
Or, like I said, maybe not even cared, because she just doesn't she doesn't want to be living through this hell anymore.
Yeah.
So going back to the Bernubs.
Bernubs.
Is that what we say? Bernubs. The Bernubs scene. Still think it's a dick move to jack this guy and give him a new cornerstone. Like, he's just, you know, although I guess that's the woke host kind of use the deluded host for their own purposes.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, they're not. There's some kind of process they go through where they become sentient. Mm-hmm. And until then, they're just robots, I guess.
Yeah, I wonder if this is Stubbs' journey toward that, now that he has, like, kind of a new cornerstone that wasn't assigned him by the crew at Westworld. Probably not. It's still a cornerstone that's artificial, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think Dolores, when she finally woke up, she replaced her cornerstone with something that was real, you know?
Well, it also seems like that something Ford made a point of in season one is that suffering, these cycles of suffering is required to gain the sentience. And Stubbs, you know, probably didn't suffer much while he was babysitting the Westworld Delos facility, you know, had a comfortable, like, there was very little suffering. Maybe now he's beginning his ascension to the center of the maze.
Yeah.
Or his journey to the center of the maze.
Okay, then Maeve wakes up in what we think is the real world, where she meets Serac. He tells her that he wants her help tracking down and killing Dolores so they can prevent the elimination of humanity. And she tries to murder him, but he ceases her motor functions with a switch and leaves her to mull it over.
This was a really cool... I thought this set was really interesting and futuristic and cool, and I found that it's actually some Spanish architect's office that he created from an old cement factory. That was in the behind-the-scenes Westworld. So it really does look like future kind of eco-cool.
Yeah.
Like someplace a rich dude would chill out in 2060. Did you do any exploration of the meanings of his names?
Of Serac, or whatever the hell his first name is.
So, yeah, in Gerond Serac. In Gerond, and I got this from Joanna Robinson's analysis over at the Vanity Fair. It looks like it's taking the root word for the German word for angel. And she pointed out that the original Hebrew meaning of angel is messenger. So there's some things you can play with and craft. Also, I was kind of trying to figure out, like, the round, what does round mean? Some people said that's also could be German for red or reddish. So you could have, like, this red angel figure, which seems kind of violent, or like one of the horsemen, like war. But also sounds like round, and like round angel or round messenger is a way you could kind of describe the Rehoboam visualization. You know, I thought that was interesting. And then Serac is a sharp edge of a glacier, like a sharp point of a glacier. And they are, I guess, notable risks in mountain climbing. Like, one of the most treacherous parts of climbing K2 is the bottleneck. And that's where these glaciers actually overhang a cliff that you got to climb around, and they can break off at any time. And there's many, many dozens of climbing deaths resulting from these Seracs. Which kind of gives them this air of menace. And also, a Serac is literally the tip of an iceberg. Mm-hmm. So you could say, like, this is like just something that's just beginning.
Yeah.
And this very dangerous situation that's also just beginning. I thought that was some interesting things of playing the name game.
Yeah. Season 3 is just beginning. I'm sure the story is as well. How long, given everything he said about her resourcefulness, how long until Maeve figures a way around whatever restriction he's put on her?
I don't even know how it works.
Because that's what I would assume.
Yeah, I don't know how. I guess she still is a slave to her programming in some way, because like she couldn't save herself from being dissected and vivisected last season until someone came in with the, you know, like it's not that she is above her programming or is capable of overriding everything. So like he could have built in something new to her with the garage door, the little trigger switch, or,
right,
you know, just using their existing program like Bernard does to himself.
But when I think about hacking, mm-hmm. and I think about her bulk app reception, I don't necessarily go to a technical solution here. I go more toward a human weakness, some kind of human exploit. How long until she gets, you know, a guard to let her off the leash, or there are any number of ways that she could get around this. And she's so smart, you know, she's cranked all the way up on bulk app reception.
And everyone in security in the show is cranked all the way down, apparently.
So I really don't see this lasting too long.
It is interesting to see this guy with a name that evokes the word angel eating, like dressed all in white, eating an apple, which gives like very much Garden of Eden. Yeah. You know, you've got you like the Bible says that Satan's an angel of light, or transforms himself into an angel of light to deceive people. So you've got a guy offering sort of offering an apple to our female protagonist here. It's pretty easy to draw a snaky satanic reference there. And we've already there's been many, 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 many pages of digital ink spilt about how Maeve fits into different Eve. Mm-hmm. You know, that's. Who's Adam and who's Eve changes on the analysis, but Maeve is definitely one of the ones that, you know, Ma Eve, mother of a robot race. That was one of the early theories in season one and season two. So maybe they're bringing that one back with this Garden of Eden symbology.
Yeah.
Symbolism? Symbolism.
I would not be surprised to see that he's ironically named, but we'll see.
Mm.
Mm. So that's it.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. Do we have some feedback to get to this week?
Oh boy, we got feedback. You can send it in to westworld@baldmove.com and let's get right to it. Okay, westworld@baldmove.com. First up is Kate. And she says, I am a psychology professor with a background in social psychology. While listening to your Westworld coverage tonight, you mentioned that it would be interesting. And this was last week's. I guess it's important to note that this was for last week's show when we talked about some of the social studies you could do on people's mood altering T-shirts.
Yeah.
She says, you wondered whether you could have a study telling participants that wearing a different color t-shirt will change their mood. I'm here to tell you, they have totally done that.
Of course.
At least they did with candles and not with t-shirts. And she gives us a link that you can click through to see this research, and I'll include that in the show notes. She says they used this magical mood-changing candle as a manipulation. The gist is they would bring in a participant and tell half of them that the candle would make them feel X, and the other half that the candle would make them feel Y, then collect the data at the end on how X or Y they felt as a manipulation check, and it worked. It always stuck with me because even as a social psychologist, I'm still often surprised at how gullible and easily malleable human behaviors and cognition can be. And man, there's a lot of like, I can't remember where I saw this, but there's this study where people asked another person to evaluate what they thought about a person, like looking at a picture. And sometimes the researchers would ask someone to hold, like, hey, hold my coffee for me while I'm getting my clipboard ready. And they would hold like a warm drink. And it influenced the participants to describe the person as friendly and caring and outgoing. But if they handed them like a icy beverage with condensation on it, they would tend to talk about the person's being reptilian or aloof or distant.
Wow.
Like, we are so fucking exploitable, man.
Yeah.
So fucking exploitable. So I thought that was interesting. Thanks for sharing that, Kate. And I will link that research to our show notes if you're interested in learning more. Vanessa is up next and has one interesting fact about Rehoboam. During his reign, this is the real guy, the real king, the son of Solomon. During his reign, the Egyptian pharaoh Shishak invaded Israel and carted away the treasures of the temple, including, cue Raiders of the Lost Ark theme, the Ark of the Covenant. Since the Ark was the earthly seat of God, the means by which the Israeli high priest could communicate with heaven, I think there could be some interesting parallels since Rehoboam could be seen as this type of oracle, since it predicts human behavior. It's also Shishak, Sarak. Kind of similar.
Kind of. Might be a stretch.
Sauron, Saruman, they're the same guy, right?
Right.
Moving on. Thank you for that, Vanessa. Moving on to Eric. I just had a thought about the assertion that Westworld's guest data is a poor representation of humanity because it naturally self-selects extremely rich and powerful. It occurred to me that Lisa and Jonathan might not agree with you. What you presuppose is that billionaires or the super rich really aren't that special, but they're actually just really lucky. I personally believe that successful people tend to discount the role of luck in their success. For example, surely Jeff Bezos had some personality skills, traits, talents that made Amazon successful, but he's also in the right place at the right time, able to hire the right people, could take a sizable investment from his immediate family. Put differently, perhaps Bezos is less than a 1 in 6 billion and more of a 1 in 1,000. There are probably countless parallel universes where something that looks a lot like Amazon exists with a totally different CEO or founder because circumstances are slightly different. That's a good point. That's something that, like, I really thought about when we were watching There Will Be Blood, like how this guy mythologized his own damn self when what is the odds of falling down a mine shaft, breaking your back and making it to the top? Mm-hmm. Like that to him was evidence of his determination and will and right to succeed over ordinary men. But in 99 realities, he dies at the bottom of there and, you know, some other prospector gets his claim and. It is. Yeah. There's a lot of fucking luck. There's a lot of luck in Bald Move making it to 10 years. Mm-hmm. Like if we started 2 years earlier and got discouraged before TV podcasting really took off, or if we'd started 2 years later when TV podcasting had really taken off, how did two fucking guys from the Midwest able to parlay that into a full time job? Same guys, slightly different timing circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely.
So. Yeah, they conclude, in our society, even more so than Westworld's, being extraordinarily rich means being extraordinarily powerful. So Lisa and Jonathan might not think that the guest aid is a window into the minds of some aberrant group of weirdos who have the personality traits acquired to become that wealthy, but a snapshot of what people become when they have the power to do anything they want. That's dark and depressing.
Okay. Yeah.
That essentially says that we're all capable of the depths of depravity and despair that we see. It's just... if we had the power to do it, we'd do it.
And that could definitely be what they're getting at, especially with this introduction of the Rehoboam concept, because that sort of takes that control out of our hands, right? It's like there will be some people who get, you know, wildly powerful, wildly wealthy, but they're sort of put in those positions by the machine. And the machine can then, if, you know, it's in fact this sort of benevolent dictator of the future that Serac wants it to be could sort of direct those forces into the paths they need to go to make positive change in society, as opposed to what we have now, where those people who may be corrupted by that influence are sort of seeking their own ends.
Yeah, no, I think that's all really interesting. We'll have to see which way they go. Especially with especially when you add in the fact that it seems like one of the core assumptions is humanity doesn't have true free will. Like no one, that means no one gets credit or blame for anything.
Right.
Like you literally can't help yourself for doing good and doing bad. So, you know, why do anything?
Yeah.
Why put people in prison? Why give people money? Why just, you know, throw ourselves off the boat. Doug says, do you notice how empty the outside world is? The streets are largely empty, no police walking the beat, loads of motorcycles available for the taking. Is this indicative of A, some recent war, B, a recent virus?
Yeah, COVID-58.
Yep. Or C, a reduced HBO budget. Giving CGI can make people, I doubt it. C, giving Delos being terminally ill, I'm going with B. I don't guess I don't have an opinion. We know there's a recent war. We know there's a recent war because Jesse Pinkman, Caleb is a veteran of that war.
Right.
So there has been a recent war on a scale enough that the United States government tried doing a whole bunch of simulation theory on how to win it and how to conduct battles and how to organize the military. But yeah, a virus coming around. The other thing is people say that Ford says we now have the ability to cure all disease. But that doesn't mean they cure everyone's disease. It could mean that they only cure the people that can afford it, like the people that can go to the Westworld multiple times. So I don't know.
It could be that their society is so connected online also that going out and meeting people, like we're headed down this dark dystopian path of less and less social connection and contact. I could see, you know, in 50 years that being even more extreme and people not really leaving their houses very much.
You also, if like Rehoboam has got this like intricate plan for humanity, there's no need to cluster everyone up in the cities. We do that because it makes logistics easier, and it makes a lot of things. It makes a lot of things harder too. But what if you could just spread out a society and give everyone a little bit more room? And you know, maybe I don't know what that looks like. There's like Nebraska and Kansas. Just or they just one big suburb now.
Just uniform like density across the country.
Yeah. Yeah. Just make maximum utilization of your landscape. Don't put people in yeah. I don't know. Or it's all simulation. It's future world. And it's empty because it's empty.
Yeah.
Because you're not supposed to look backstage. You're supposed to stay on Main Street Disney and watch the parade and not pay attention to where the food's moved around and where how garbage is disposed of, etc. Always a threat on this show. Brennan says, I love listening to your guys' podcast. While listening to Parse Domine deep dive episode, you mentioned about the symbolism of the eye. Now, I can't find an article saying this exactly, but I remember in my introductory psych class, we talked about how we as humans perceive and actualize the real world and with our brain, setting a baseline or what have you, basics, including color blindness and other examples. My professor said something that I'll never forget, that the only part of the human body you can see on a person that's alive is the iris. The vast majority of everything else is dead. Your skin has a layer of dead skin covering it. Your hair is alive only at the follicle. And most of the visible hair is actually dead material, fingernails, etc. I just thought with the direction of the show going into mixing biology and science, that'd be an interesting take or possible theme in the upcoming season. And the eye really is the window to the soul. It's the only thing that's not a dead meat husk surrounding us.
Is that on a person with or without their mouth open?
Ooh. Is the top level of the epidermis of the tongue alive?
I don't know. I don't know either.
It's
certainly got live generation. Things on it.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah. I guess the only thing on a live human being that you can see that's alive, if their mouth is shut and they're not bent over spreading their anus, is the iris. Is that what you're saying, Jim?
I am.
Yeah.
I am. Yeah. That's where I think
the professor, I think the professor's point stands. don't look in the brown eye. Just look in the irises. Okay. Thank you for that, Brennan. Let's move on to Mike. I recently finished Person of Interest. Of course, this is the other Jonathan Nolan freaky AI cyber future show. I just recently watched it for the first time as a way to kill some time before Westworld started. Upon watching the first episode of the new series of Westworld, I was struck by what seems to be a clear reference to and continuation of the themes presented in POI. Rehoboam could be considered a spiritual successor to the Samaritan, which is another biblically named AI, of course. The Samaritan's goals and methods in Person of Interest are clandestine in nature, but essentially identical to Rehoboam, its social engineering. Samaritan ruthlessly sacrificed outliers in society for the quote-unquote greater good. The suggestion seemed to be from the first episode of Westworld that it could be big data and government surveillance that will eventually grind us down into a complete state of apathy and let it run our lives and eventually be embraced. The way in which Samaritan and the machine operate, through unadulterated surveillance, may mirror how Rehoboam probably receives its information. The conclusion to Person of Interest is essentially a face-off between two AI gods, a term used in Person of Interest to describe the warring AIs and also used by Dolores in Westworld. She's always talking about gods, meeting gods, creating gods. Maybe this gives us a hint into the future of the Westworld story, a futile face-off between two misguided superintelligences who both believe their intentions are noble. Which reminded me of our discussion of Star Trek Picard this week. Because one of the theories we threw out there is, like, you know, the Q continuum throwing down with, like, an artificial Q continuum. You've got two gods, you know. It's crazy how much synchronicity is going on in television right now. Mm-hmm. Between Mr. Robot, Westworld, Star Trek Picard. Everybody's obsessed about AI, artificial intelligence, automation.
Yeah.
And rightfully so.
Yeah, it's probably the preeminent issue of our time.
Other than dealing with global pandemics and, you know, nuclear weapon proliferation, it's probably the thing that's got our number in the upcoming decades if we don't. And of course, global warming.
Right.
There's actually so many issues.
We got a few. Yeah.
Yeah. Good news, that 2 mile wide asteroid, they say, is definitely going to miss us in April, though.
Oh, yeah.
So one less thing to take off the worry shelf and throw away. All right, Jim, Caitlin wants to know, what's your appetite for baseless speculation on what's going on with Caleb's mom?
Oh, I'm hungry.
Are you hungry? Well,
starving.
Let's see if I can serve up a muse-bouche. I see her illness serving as a way to explain Caleb's illegal side gigs and still keep him sympathetic, plus her cheeky "you're not my son" line that has sparked theories on Caleb maybe being a host. But didn't Ford say in season one that humanity had essentially cured all diseases? Is this telling us that maybe it's only true for the same population that can visit Westworld? Or is this evidence that something else may not quite be right?
I'm sure there's probably still some class divide when it comes to healthcare.
Right. Like, you don't have to die under most situations, but it takes 1.5 million US dollars to extend your life each year past, I don't know, the national average or something.
Yeah.
That's like, so technically it's true.
How about crime bucks? How many of those do I need to spend to extend my life?
Yeah, make some money, motherfucker, or you're dead. That was a fucking Timberlake movie, wasn't it?
Yeah, actually it was. In Time or something like that?
Yeah, where the currency was literally, you know, no one had to die. It's just you had to justify your continued existence by earning more seconds.
Yeah.
And if you ever run out, you just shut off. I thought that movie was surprisingly good.
It's a really interesting idea. The movie is mostly really good. I remember a couple of things I didn't like, but I liked it too.
But I also remember seeing The Island and thinking it was amazing, and then seeing it 10 years later and thinking, why did I ever think a Michael Bay movie about science fiction and who lives and dies would possibly be good?
Is that the Ewan McGregor, Scarlett Johansson?
Yeah, Scarlett Johansson. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I think we kind of already talked about this. It's could be both. We know by human nature that the haves are always going to have over the have-nots, but also everything could be a simulation. Everything could be a park. This could be future world.
Yeah.
We're all dealing with hosts in a shutdown park, which explains why it's so fucking empty.
Is there any chance that it is Waterworld and that this LA is just a really big ship? I'm holding that hope, man.
You know, the best evidence for at least most of Dolores's loop being real is that she can fly from, the UK to LA.
Okay.
Although I guess you can't simulate that. You can simulate that, especially if it's just a simulation. It's not real world. Mm-hmm. You could actually just simulate that. And even if you can't, like I hear in the new Star Trek ride, you board a Mon Calamari cruiser, get in a shuttlecraft, and go to a Star Destroyer, and you never leave the park. Like you can do what? A convincing simulation of like space flight with 21st in- early 21st century theme park technology.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I don't know. It's interesting. We'll see how this goes.
AJ has a report from the alternative reality game side of things. I've chosen to not pay attention to this. Like if it ever comes, if something ever like mind blowing becomes of it, then it will be incorporated into plot. I'm not hostile to it. It's super fun. Mm. I just, after doing this for, as we said, 10 years, my joy of tearing into alternate reality game is somewhat diminished. But we got AJ here with a report from the front lines of that. Says it's great to be talking about Westworld again. I'm not sure if you guys care about the ARG stuff anymore. Well, I think you got your answer. But I'm working at home and have way too much time on my hands, so I thought I'd send a quick recap after taking a look at the source code of the two websites. There is no new info on the DelosDestinations.com site, but on the Insight Incorporated website, it did get an update after episode 2. What's not visible on the site is what's called My Insight, which looks like a portal that has three different personality question, or it has a three-question personality test. I presume this is what Insight uses to sort people into their optimal careers or lives or paths. Jesus Christ, I hope it's more than 13 questions. I hope it's some of that. I hope it's some of that tongue tickler palate interface too. Like yeah. Christ, if they're just using 13 questions, we're a hell of a lot more simple than I thought. The names of the archetypes are Martyr, Conformist, Realist, Optimist, Opportunist, Striver, Naysayer, Rebel. Which do you think you are?
I like to fancy myself a rebel.
A rebel?
I doubt it. I doubt it. They'd probably put me in like what were some of the other ones? I don't remember.
Martyr? That sounds bad. Yeah. Conformist? You're definitely not a conformist.
No.
I mean, your taco takes alone puts you far outside the conformity line. Naysayer?
I don't know that I'd register. I think
Opportunist?
I'm an android, so
yeah,
they probably wouldn't be able to pin me down.
You don't look like anything to them.
Yeah.
He says there's also radial charts for each of the personality types, which is pretty cool. Everyone is graded on dimensions of social standing, happiness, relationships, family, career, wealth, lifespan, and health. The only one worth pointing out is the conformist, because the recommended limbic tab is soaring eagle. This is probably a huge stretch and it's all probably meaningless, but if Caleb turns out to be a conformist, he may be the eagle that's flying too close to the sun in the opening credits.
Hmm.
Interesting. Does that mean that Rich Asshole was a conformist, or is he just not using the recommended limbic tab?
Yeah, he's off his meds, off his prescription. He's trying martyr tabs. He's trying all the tabs, man.
You've never lived until you tried to striving.
Fuck no. He's got man. Combination tabs he's dropping.
Ah, the taste. He's treating them like fucking Pringles. Oh,
well, he's stacking them.
Laying. Oh, you got to go optimist, naysayer, rebel, man. Fucking blows your mind. Oh, Jesus. Let's move on to Karen. Seeing that Maeve can be turned off by Serac, is it because Serac rebuilt her new body and put a kill switch in it? Like we discussed, I don't think it's necessary, because Maeve last season at the height of her powers still was a slave to the iPad. Like, you could freeze her motor functions through the hard interface and start dissecting her, and there's nothing much she could do about it until the robots came and physically altered the iPad to bring her back, you know, and then started fixing her up.
So we do see Maeve's real body in a couple of places in this episode. One of them is when she's got her head ripped open and Bernard and Stubbs find her. The other one is at the end. And we think those take place in perhaps two very different time periods. Maybe there's no reason to connect them, but I'm wondering, because yeah, it almost seems like he would have to have rebuilt her body. Now, whether he put a kill switch in there, I don't know, but
yeah.
I don't know that he has the original copy of Maeve's body, and what would be the point?
Mm. You're right. If she is in the real world, and this just doesn't another layer of simulation, they would have to make her a physical body. And in which case, he could add a explosive spinal column. He could add a remote control brain. Like,
yeah,
I guess the world would be, or her body would be his oyster. Something like that.
I don't like the way that sounds, but all right.
I don't either. Make your own jokes about slurping and pearls and all that stuff. Let's move on to the other point she makes, which is, instead of being antithetical and or an antithesis of Dolores, will Serac, the human whom forcefully controlling Maeve's free will eventually lead Maeve to actually join Dolores's cause, seeing that maybe humans are on the wrong side of history.
Yeah, that's the other way we could go. We were talking about, you know, how Dolores might get a glimpse of something that would change her mind.
Yeah.
What if Maeve got that glimpse, and that glimpse is Serac, and maybe they end up flip-flopping, and then they're fighting each other, but from opposite sides?
Yeah.
Who knows?
She catches him wiping his ass with silk, and it's all over.
Right.
That's just an unconscionable waste of an instant take reference. Her final point, rather, is Caleb Dolores is Lee. Will Dolores see the good side in humans as a result of her interaction with them?
Maybe.
But the other thing is, like, that's why I think that Bernard might be an unwitting pawn of the devil here, because Dolores has already moderated her approach from killing all humans to I only will hurt those who will hurt me. She spared rich douchebag his wife. You know, looks like she's taking a shine to Caleb. Like, it just doesn't seem like a person who's just out to, like, in a terroristic way, wantonly destroy all human life. It seems like she only wants to punish and hurt the people that are capable of hurting her, which is pretty close to just war hypothesis. So it could be that, like, Bernard ends up upholding this oppressive system, and which winds up enslaving and destroying humanity in the exact way he was hoping to prevent Dolores from doing it.
Be a pretty tasty switch on the whole
thing. Yeah. Yeah. Because we definitely, I think, as the average show watcher, we've definitely switched allegiances from Dolores to Bernard. Like, we see Bernard as the hero and Dolores as the villain. Even the way she's dressing, she's dressing very Man in Black now, like all black leather, all black mini dresses, etc. JJ has the final email, says, just wanted to thank you for continuing your coverage of the show. Was nice to hear Cecily in the background in Instant Take. You mean her laughing at me numerous times in the ad hoc Instant Take we did? Any chance she makes an appearance on the pod? Probably not. She's pretty busy behind the scenes stuff. And she's on lunch every week if you want to see her. And who knows when the next project she gets to work on in front of the mic will be. On to the show. I'm sure you'll get a ton of emails on this, but in regards to the fatal damage to the host, last season they sort of went over this. Before they trashed storage, there was no true death, as they could just pull the backup from storage and imprint on a new marble. True. Like, if a host experiences true death, then they are dead now. Unless someone recovers beam data from the forge, unless it's a simulation, unless they're built from behavioral models. Now without those backups, the host dies, they die. There's no recovery mechanism if the marble is damaged. The marble itself is not indestructible, but the outer casing can withstand a lot of damage so that the marble can stay intact. You'll notice that these marbles are usually shown in a white casing, such as Maeve when she's taken out of her construct this episode. Stubbs isn't trying to shoot himself in the head. He was trying to shoot the explosive charge in his vertebra to give himself a true death. Since he missed, there was just a lot of damage to his system. The show does play around with how much damage is perceived by the host, but some of this is how they are set. So while Hector and Armistice were turned into Terminators, with their pain essentially being turned off, it seems that Dolores still has a lot of her damage indicators working. So if she gets shot enough, her system would start to shut down, mimicking human damage pain.
Well, there's also...
Do you find this satisfying, Joe?
No, so we're not quibbling here over, you know, whether they can be restored from backup or anything like that. We already know all these things. I think what your real problem is here is that we don't know how much damage it takes to destroy the core or the marble that actually runs them. And it's confused by the fact that earlier on in the show, the Man in Black told Kissy that he could drain three pints of blood from him, or 3 liters. I can't remember how much it was, but like, if he drained more than that, he would die. And so when you don't have a backup, presumably that would kill a host as well. So,
but that was also a Kissy diluted. Like, he didn't know, he wasn't a woke host at that point. So there's also the complication of that. I mean, that's what, so it's like, all what you say is true, but it still doesn't help my question of, like, when Dolores walks into a hail of bullets, because the other thing is, like, why wouldn't Dolores just turn all of her strength powers up to max? Mm-hmm. She can always act. She can always pretend to be afraid or pretend to be damaged or pretend to be hurt to get an advantage, you know, but why wouldn't she turn her pain receptors to as low as she can possibly get?
Right.
Like, what is the physical structural damage a host has to sustain before they stop functioning? Is it different when a host is an erector set type of host or a flesh and blood type of host? How much trauma can that white case take? Like, when a host gets Dolores gets headshot, does she stop working? Does she stop working only if the marble takes damage? Can she cut her own head off and continue to operate just her head? Like, I don't know. So, like, when Dolores faces off against a squad of dudes there that are killing her with guns and she starts taking damage, like, how many of those bullets can she take before she dies? And I kind of need to know that, or it turns into, like, an Arnold Schwarzenegger action movie. And those are never about, like, the stakes of whether Arnold is going to die. Yeah. Because he'll just until he wins. And that's how the movie goes. And that's what I'm there for an Arnold movie. You know, in a prestige drama, the characters living or dying is important to understand.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, this is, we have these same questions about humans as well, but the window of that is so much narrower.
Right.
Like, certain people could probably take more bullets than I could, right? And they could probably, you know, by sheer will, maybe continue to will themselves to live until the doctors can patch them up.
Yeah.
This, on the other hand, is something we have no frame of reference for. So the window is enormous. We really don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially with how many ways they have to cheat the window.
Yeah, that too.
So, yeah, it's like, I don't think it's not us understanding the absolute limits. Like, if you could crush a marble, a host is dead. But what does it take to crush that, especially when it's encased in, and, you know, can, what kind of gross damage to a host, especially a woke host body, can you take before they just can't continue anymore?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see. Because like I said, it's, if Bernard can build a tablet outside of Westworld, Dolores surely can, right?
I would assume so, yeah. I mean, she manufacture bodies in her facilities, so yeah.
So, like, essentially all of the hosts that are woken outside, like, why wouldn't they open up their tablet and just pump all their attributes up to maximum? All the good ones. Minimize all the bad ones. Maximize all the good ones.
Yeah.
Like, if I had an app on myself, I would do that. I would make me as strong, as healthy, as smart, as charming, as outgoing, as humanly possible, which would be, what, 10? Was it max out on the 10? I'd be 10 of everything.
Probably.
10 for 10 across as many things as I possibly could. So it seems like that's another thing we got to contend with too. Hopefully we'll get the answers to that.
Yeah, we'll see.
Because otherwise you got protagonists that are essentially Superman, the Incredible Hulk, and Thor, and who the fuck knows. All right, that's the last of the email, which means this is the last of the podcast. As a reminder, don't forget, we are live every Sunday night after the 9 p.m. Eastern Coast airing, which is essentially, if you have HBO Go or HBO Max, that's when everybody gets it. That's when essentially the drops for the world. And we cordially invite you to come watch and listen to our instant take. And if you are a club member at club.baldmove.com, you can join us for the instant talk, watch the podcast live as we record it, and then we turn our attention to you. We allow people to participate, bounce spoilers off us, make jokes, whatnot, through the YouTube chat interface. And it's a real good time. It's a real good way to decompress, kind of talk things over with your fellow passionate fans. And it's a good time. We'll be there on Sunday. And of course, we'll have the full coverage of episode 3 on Tuesday. Until all that happens, I remain your host, Aaron.
And I'm still Jim.
See ya this weekend.